Hi, welcome to another podcast by the Oxford Society for International Development. My name is Esther Coomber and I am the Europe Events Officer. I'm in my second year studying history at Magdalen College. I'm very excited to be bringing you one of the final podcasts of the term. I'm delighted to be joined today by Nahir Dasandi. In this podcast, we will be exploring the challenges facing European and global democracies, ranging from social media to climate change. Nahir, thank you so much for joining me today and welcome to the podcast. Could you please start by introducing yourself?
Yeah, my name is Nahir Dasandi. I'm an associate professor in the International Development Department at the University of Birmingham. And I work on issues related to development, human rights, and more recently, climate change and health as well.
Let's start by looking at the definition of democracy. So what does democracy mean and what does a democratic society look like?
Yeah, it's a really important question, and I think it's one that's very much debated, and it's part of the sort of current debate over democracy. So, you know, at the heart of it, when we think about democracy, we think about the rule of the people or the people being sovereign, but that can mean like lots of different things in different contexts. And so the definition that I've tended to use of democracy is the one that Larry Diamond, who's a political sociologist or political scientist, puts forward, which is that it sort of comprises of four parts. So the first is competitive elections or a competitive turnover of power, competition for power. And we think about this mostly in the form of free and fair elections. The second part being people sort of actively participating in political and civic life. So this could be through voting, it can be through standing in politics, it can be through civil society. The third aspect would be, you know, the protection of basic human rights for individuals, which, again, there's some variation in what, you know, across different societies, what we'd consider as those sort of basic rights, but certainly some notion of protecting individual rights. And then finally, the fourth would be the rule of law, so that, you know, decisions and laws made by rulers are not sort of arbitrary, but there's a system in place and leaders are held accountable as well, so that there are rules in place which everyone has to follow. So those would be the four sort of core parts of what we mean by democracy. But then in terms of what that looks like in practice, I think there can be huge variation in how that plays out.
That leads us on to my next question about, can democracy mean different things to different societies and cultures, or is it a universal idea with set criteria?
Yeah, again, it's a really good question, and it's not an easy question, because I think I certainly think that there can be different notions of what democracy means according to different societies and different cultures. I think particularly when we're talking, when we move away from, let's say, national politics or state level politics to sort of more local government, local forms of government and local autonomy, I think, you know, at that point we can talk about democratic processes looking quite different. However, I'd be very cautious about, I think part of the ways in which democracy is currently sort of being undermined is by challenging the definition of what democracy is. So I think while there is scope when we think about, you know, particularly at a more local sort of level or autonomous level of smaller communities, we can think about, you know, whether democracy takes very different shapes. In terms of state level or national politics, I do think that those four sort of elements that I set out, I do think they are, even though they may look very different in different places, and I think there is scope for those to look quite different, I think having those four parts in when we talk about sort of national level democracy, I think is really important. And again, you know, I think it is worth emphasizing that there is huge variation within those four elements. So, you know, even when we think about the differences between a sort of parliamentary democracy or a presidential democracy, you know, they can look very different, and the way things play out is very different. So I don't think it's this sort of hard sort of notion of this is exactly what democracy is and everything else is non-democratic. But I do think that those four elements are really important.
In this podcast, we're going to discuss the challenges that contemporary democracy is facing. But firstly, let's consider, what does democracy being under threat actually mean?
Yeah, so, and this is why I do think it's really important to have some sort of common understanding of what we mean by democracy, because I think part of what I mean, I think democracy is currently really only under threat if we accept a certain definition of democracy. And so if we talk about, for example, the definition I've mentioned, which is having those four parts, I think the threat has come because one part of that, or one element of that democratic system, namely sort of coming to power through elections, is being used to undermine the other three parts. So what we're seeing is actually, you know, people increasingly, there's fewer and fewer examples, although I should say, you know, recently there have been a few coups in Africa, but generally we're seeing fewer examples of leaders not coming to power through elections, as in most leaders around the world come to power through elections. And so, you know, electoral democracy to some extent, I mean, there's a big question over how free and fair those elections are, but at least there is legitimacy over elections. Where we're seeing the challenges is often those leaders that come to power through the ballot box, through winning elections, are then using that sort of popular support to undermine things like civil society, the rule of law, to undermine the rights of minority groups or fundamental human rights more generally. And I think that's where the threat is at the moment. It's a really big threat as well.
To begin with, can you tell us about the shifts in European democracy over the last 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, it's so I think it's worth just going back a bit to say, you know, in particularly in the early 2000s, late in the 90s and early 2000s, there was a lot of optimism and a lot of positive change around democracy with, you know, the breakdown of the Soviet Union, and the sort of this led to new states arising who increasingly became more democratic. We saw the same. So in Central and Eastern Europe, we saw trends towards democracy. And I think what's happened in the last 10 years or so is that progress has stalled. And I think in a lot of places, not just in Central and Eastern Europe, I think more generally in Europe, we're seeing real threats to that democracy. And we're seeing real, very clear examples when we look at countries like, you know, Hungary would be the obvious example, Poland too, where we're seeing examples of democratic backsliding, where certain parts of those countries' democracies are now being like very, very much undermined. And we're seeing it in a range of countries, and, you know, countries that were quite, were only just moving on towards the path of sort of becoming democratic, like more recently, like Serbia, we're seeing sort of trends where that's really being reversed. So I think, yeah, the last 5 to 10 years, I think it's in some countries we're seeing real clear examples of democratic backsliding, and in other more established democracies in Europe, we're also seeing the influence of sort of populism and far-right politics, you know, becoming quite clear there.
And then to place Europe and the European situation within the geographical context and global context, what are the current trends across democracies globally?
Yeah, it's, I mean, at the moment it's a really difficult time to say, partly because of the pandemic and the impact that's had and what does that mean, because I think it's still quite hard to see exactly what's going on in places with you know, the COVID-19 pandemic on. I think more generally though, Europe, you'd say is representative of global trends in democracy, which is in the last 10 years we're seeing, we're seeing in a lot of places sort of the rise of populism, attacks on a free and fair sort of independent media. We're seeing attacks on political opponents. We're seeing civil society being increasingly constrained and attacked as well. So I think Europe is probably not that dissimilar to the global trend that we've seen in the last 10 years, which is that there has been this real, there's real indicators of democratic backsliding globally as well.
You've spoken about what does democracy being under threat actually mean, and you've mentioned some of the issues facing democracy, but what would you say are some of the biggest challenges facing democracy at the moment?
Yeah, I think since the sort of 2008 global financial crisis, I think there's been a number of challenges that sort of have emerged from there, or a number of things that have kind of arisen from that are really threatening democracy. So one is, I think, what we're seeing is the rise of populism or the regrowth of populism. And by that, I'm talking about, you know, general citizen dissatisfaction or disengagement with sort of formal politics, which has then led to sort of these charismatic leaders coming along and using that sort of dissatisfaction to sort of, you know, appeal to these appeal to that dissatisfied sort of citizenry to sort of appeal to their fears and to really sort of then have this sort of effectively it's the pitting of the people versus the establishment, and then at the same time sort of demonizing minority groups and using that all to sort of enhance their own power. And I think we're certainly seeing lots of examples of that occurring, and I mean most notably in the US it was with Donald Trump and his election, which very much was along, you know, I think few would dispute that that was very much sort of a clear example of populism. I think linked to that, the high levels of political polarization we're seeing, and we see it in the UK, we see it in other parts of Europe, in the US, and I think globally, which is you're seeing increasingly, you know, lots of aspects of life becoming highly politicized and charged and you know, less thought being given. And I think the issue with political polarization, so what we mean is, you know, increasingly people are sort of splitting into groups, we can call it like liberals versus more conservatives or however those that sort of political cleavage takes place. But it's what we're seeing is rather than sort of people engaging seriously with the issues in front of them, it becomes much more about what does my side think about this issue and where does my side stand, and I'm going to take that stand no matter what. And increasingly, I think with the COVID pandemic, I don't think it was a big surprise where the fault lines sort of fell in terms of those that didn't want any restrictions whatsoever versus those calling for restrictions. It's sort of, you know, increasingly we're seeing a link between issues on, you know, like climate change, where again, we know where if you're more liberal, where you're going to sit versus if you're more conservative. And I think that polarization is certainly a big issue. So it's a big challenge. Other things, I think, you know, and I think both the populism and the polarization are partly driven by just the high levels of economic inequality that we're seeing. And it's a particular form of inequality where I think it's the growing sort of wealth that's being amassed right at the top. I think it not only sort of undermines democratic politics in terms of the influence that then certain groups and certain people have, I think it fuels this discontent with democracy, where it's clear that, you know, the system feels very unfair for many, many people. So I think that's another issue. I think, again, linked to that, you know, the rise of social media, I don't think social media in itself is necessarily has to be problematic, but I think in the context of polarization, in the context of this dissatisfaction and populism, I think it has been a real instrument that has helped sort of foster that polarization. I think it's generally, at the moment, it feels like it very much sort of undermines democratic politics. So yeah, there's a whole, and then obviously most recently with the pandemic, I think it's still unclear like what the long-term impacts of the pandemic on democracy will be, but it's certainly having a huge impact, and it could potentially have a really big one going forward in terms of, you know, what we've seen is with this huge sort of like upheaval that's occurred, we've seen sort of the biggest constraints on people's rights that we've seen in a long time, and you'd argue that, you know, that was needed to sort of contain a highly infectious and transmittable like pandemic. But I think the long-term implications of that and the anger it's sort of generated amongst certain people, amongst a certain sector of society, I think all of these things are big challenges for democracy going forward.
You mentioned about populism and Donald Trump. Are there similar instances in Europe, and could you give some examples?
Yeah, so I think the most obvious example of a similar sort of figure would be, I guess if we're talking Europe, it would be, you'd argue that even pre-Trump you had Putin in Russia is an example of a, you know, there's aspects of that populist model that he certainly employs. So you'd argue that it's, you know, arguably he's more it's not just populism. There's a more sort of a sort of more authoritarian nature to the Putin regime, but there's certainly that populist there's certainly populist aspects to it. And then Viktor Orban in Hungary is probably the example most people would turn to as someone, you know, very charismatic, strong, you know, particularly performed very well in terms of elections early on, has used that to sort of really fuel this discontent with, like, you know, what's seen as the European sort of liberal elite within the country and the EU, has sort of very much used that model of demonizing minority groups, particularly sort of with the migrant crisis that occurred, and has used that then to really curtail rights, to sort of, you know, very much, you know, anti-LGBT rights, and using this rhetoric of it being against sort of the Christian values of the country. Attacks on the media, very similar to Trump, attacks on the media, and also attacks on the judiciary in the country as well. So I think Viktor Orban's probably the closest example to a Trump. But then again, we could also turn to Erdogan in Turkey as well. I think very similar figure in terms of populist and undermining certain aspects of that democratic system. So I think there's a few examples, but they're the ones that, yeah, immediately jump out. Yeah.
What impact does media and social media have on democracy? This was kind of an issue that was particularly played out in Brexit and the issues with Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah, it's so in terms of, I mentioned those four elements of what a democracy is. So I think, you know, an independent press, an independent media, you know, is one of the key institutions that helps uphold those four elements. So, you know, without an independent media, citizens can't engage with political and civic life without having, you know, that information available to them and accurate information freely available to them. So just to say, first of all, that I think, you know, the media itself is crucial. A functioning independent media, a free media, is crucial to a well-functioning democracy. And I think there's a few issues. So again, you know, as much as with the populism and the rise of populism, we sort of often overlook aspects of the system that weren't really working as well as they could have been, which have allowed this populism to rise. So we tend to sort of, you know, focus on the individual populist leaders who often do carry a lot of the sort of blame for what's going on. But equally, I think it's important we do remember that it's existing systems that have allowed that sort of dissatisfaction to ferment. And one of the things I do think is, you know, as much as I think in most democratic countries, we do have access to a free media, there is the issue of increasingly the media being owned by large corporations and what that means for the type of, you know, the type of journalism that we have and the sort of vested interests that then control very powerful media outlets. So I think that's been an issue. And I think that in itself has led to a certain level of dissatisfaction. And then at the same time, when you then have the rise of sort of social media and alternative news sources, I think what you then have is, you know, this people being very, a lot of people being very frustrated with the way society is functioning, feeling that it is deeply unfair, seeing the sort of mainstream media with certain corporate interests as being part of that problem and turning to alternative news sources, which sadly, you know, in some cases there are some great sort of alternative news sources, but often, you know, there to sort of, you know, do not provide like accurate information about what's really going on. So a lot of misinformation. And then, you know, on social media, where it sort of, until very recently, there were very few restrictions on the ways in which information can be presented or be, you know, claimed to be true. And so, you know, we have this huge spread of misinformation. We have people being given a voice to really spread that misinformation as well. So I think the system, like the media system, media and social media, is certainly a big part of the issue. But I don't think we can just say it's social media has ruined everything. I don't think that's quite the case. I think it's that it's contributed to what is a long-standing issue with the way in which, you know, how, like the role of the media in society and the ways in which the media comes under attack as well.
So in the issues about democracy, you spoke about the COVID-19 pandemic. How do you think this has affected the public's trust in democracy?
Yeah, it's. It varies, because I think already, I mean, it's been, 2 years, and I think we've seen big, sort of already big switches in the way that relationship between government and the public in the context of the pandemic has changed. So I think, you know, initially, in some places, I think, and the US potentially being one of them, it actually highlighted the flaws of some of these populist leaders. And, you know, the other aspect of populism, which I didn't mention, which I think is really important when we talk about the pandemic, is the sort of very simple, it's a very simple narrative about what the problems of society are. So it's often that, you know, the problems of society are this sort of liberal elite, and by challenging that, we can solve all of society's problems. And it's a very simple narrative about who's to blame for what's going on. And actually, what the pandemic revealed is, you know, societies are far more complex than that, that the issues we face are far more complex, and we do need to accept and engage with that complexity. And if you try to, if you put in place someone that is unwilling to engage with that and sort of wants to find these easy solutions, things can go very wrong very quickly. So I think, on the one hand, in some places, I think the pandemic has highlighted the need to move away from these sort of charismatic leaders who offer, you know, these easy solutions, but actually haven't engaged with the issues anywhere near well enough, and don't engage with political and policies in the way that they should. And if anything, it sort of reinforced the role of expertise, which is, again, you know, with populism, often it's about, as well as that sort of, as part of that elite, it's often, you know, experts, however that's defined, whether that's scientists or policy experts in other fields. And I think, so to some extent, I think there has been, I think there's evidence to show that people have become, you know, it's increased trust in scientists and doctors and in policy experts, at the expense of these sort of populist leaders, I think, in some contexts. On the other hand, I think it's also been, it's enabled governments to bring in, you know, these are a hugely significant restrictions, which, again, as I said, I think often were justified. But the issue is, in contexts where you've got governments that have already been looking to undermine things like individual rights and you know, civil society, I think it's been very dangerous in terms of the types of measures it's brought in. And I think the question will be how much of that will stay long term. You know, what extent will that be rolled back as you know, fingers crossed, the pandemic, you know, we ease out of the pandemic context. In terms of trust in government, I think we're seeing, again, it's sort of waves, because at the moment, I mean, if you look at, you know, across Europe, across in Canada, I think, on the one hand, there's clearly a lot of anger at certain restrictions, but I think it's important not to, it's often quite an angry sort of minority. And it's very difficult then, because it's such a vocal and active minority that are sort of very against these measures, we can perhaps overstate what it means for distrust in government. I think the majority of people, particularly, let's say, in a European context, I think have, while maybe not happy with all of the restrictions, have certainly accepted that they were necessary. The issue will be, you know, when you do get these sorts of protests and these sorts of movements that are against the government around COVID restrictions, I think the danger is the way in which then the government responds in turn. And I think in Canada that is a bit of an issue, in terms of like the force at which then the government responds in turn, I think, you know, can be quite detrimental long term for trust between citizens and governments.
Moving on to a different aspect of democracy, what role does the European Union play in Europe's democracies?
I mean, so part of the sort of the founding principles of the EU are that it's a collection of sort of representative democracy. It's an organization made up of representative democracies. And so as part of that, I think there's a really important issue around the norms of representative democracy. And I certainly think it plays a really big role in trying to at least shape norms and ensure that there is this notion that that societies that are part of the EU should be representative democracies. It also plays a role, not just in sort of that sort of norms and ideas. It's also, you know, to join the EU, a lot of countries have had to demonstrate that they have seriously implemented procedures that make them a representative democracy. And so, you know, this is one of the things that when we saw, for example, the 2004 EU enlargement, which brought in a lot of sort of Central and Eastern European countries, that, you know, there was this notion that they had been strongly incentivized to adopt democratic processes in order to join the EU. So I think, you know, in terms of its membership, in terms of the ideas it holds, it certainly promotes sort of liberal democracy. It monitors, you know, as part of its role, it sort of also has this sort of monitoring role on the ways in which its member states are performing with regard to democracy. So I think certainly there's also it sort of promotes a democracy. I think in the past, in particular, there have been a lot of questions about the EU itself, and you know, how democratic is the EU, and this notion of a sort of legitimacy gap or democratic deficit within the EU. And that's, I think, been an important issue, and it sort of led to the formation of the European Parliament. I think that sort of is still an ongoing sort of issue with any sort of supranational institution. So any international organization relative to then its member states, it's quite a difficult relationship in terms of democracy to sort of really manage that, because the EU, while it's clearly, you know, it's made up of democratic members, it becomes far trickier then to where countries do deviate from that democracy. I think it's a very difficult one for the EU to act. And I think that's certainly been the case when we look at Poland and Hungary in the last few years, where it's clear that there have been significant sort of, there's been clear democratic backsliding. And I think partly due to the internal politics of member states, partly due to things like Brexit and just, you know, the EU itself having to navigate certain political issues, you'd say it hasn't managed to really do too much to prevent that democratic backsliding in two of its, you know, key member states.
Looking at contemporary media coverage of Ukraine and the predicted Russian invasion, what can this tell us about the current state of European democracy?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and I'm not sure it tells us too much, in that I think it's far more an issue of geopolitics and international politics than necessarily being about democracy. Although, you know, you'd argue that if, for example, Russia was a more democratic system and Putin was a more democratic leader, you know, I would argue, and I'm sure many people would dispute this, but that there'd be less inclination for that confrontation. I think, you know, he'd have to think much more about whether how this would play out in terms of support within Russia, amongst the population, amongst how the media would report on it, how civil society would engage with this. And because he has, you know, there is the independent media in Russia has all but been wiped out, or certainly heavily under pressure and heavily attacked. And the same with civil society. It means he certainly doesn't face those constraints, because he's managed to effectively end those sorts of constraints on his executive power. So you'd argue that that's certainly an issue. I don't quite buy the, you know, I think, and this might just be certain parts of the US media that present this as a battle between democracy and authoritarianism in Europe. And I don't think that that's quite the case. I don't think Ukraine, you know, I think Ukraine, like a number of other countries in the region, it's partially democratic. I think there are significant limitations with its own democracy in terms of the way the Ukrainian government has dealt with the media and civil society and the rights of minority groups. So I'm not sure it's quite a battle between like democracy and authoritarianism. And I don't think it tells us quite as much about democracy as it does about the geopolitics of the region. But yeah, certainly there is an aspect at which democracy is really important for what's going on.
Is democracy still an effective way to rule and govern society? I think this has been something that a lot of people focus on, particularly as people focus on the success of China following the pandemic or similar situation.
It's certainly a question that I don't think it's a particularly new question, in that I think what we had was a period from the, particularly in the sort of 90s or maybe from the 80s to the early 2000s, where it was just very clear that democracies were outperforming even economically other systems. But I don't think it's a new question, in that I think it's a question that I think, so my own background in international development, you see this question has been asked when we look, you know, more recently the focus is on China, but, you know, historically we've looked at countries like the East Asian Tigers, so, you know, South Korea and Singapore and Taiwan, and these countries, you know, achieved huge amounts of economic progress and transformation, you'd argue, under what were quite authoritarian governments. And so this argument's always been made that, you know, is democracy the most effective form of government? And I would still, I would certainly argue it is. And I think we only need to look, so I think A, we need to consider a longer term perspective over what we mean by effective. And so of course, in the short term, countries that are not democratic may do extremely well economically, but I do think there's a question of that long term economic stability, whether we see that. I think if we look at individual rights, for example, and I mean, we can look at the example of China and the Uyghurs to say, actually, and that's not to say, just to be clear, it's not to say that human rights violations don't take place in countries that are considered democratic. They do. But you'd still say, you know, democracies have been far better at protecting the rights of individuals. I think the economic aspect is going to be a big question going forward, in terms of within a globalized world, within a context where China is clearly a major power economically, as well as politically. I think there's certainly democracy will be under more pressure than it's been under when the US was, like, you know, very clearly the sort of global hegemon. So I think I would argue yes, but I think with certain new threats that are emerging, there is real pressure on democracy. I mean, there was a paper that came out in the American Political Science Review recently, by Ross Mittiger, and it was quite controversially received. I don't think the paper itself was that controversial. And the argument was effectively, I think the argument was along the lines of, with the threats posed by climate change, what this will do is, if we don't take action within democratic society, if democratic societies are not able to take adequate action on the climate, there is a real risk that then authoritarian governments are seen as far more legitimate in because they're able to deal with this crisis in a better way. And I do think, at least, and maybe I've misrepresented the argument a bit, but, like, effectively, I do think this is a serious concern when we've got these sort of rising global threats. And at the same time, we are seeing lots of major democracies around the world highly polarized in terms of their politics. The ability for these governments and countries to be able to act and respond, I think, is a real issue. But yeah, I'd still maintain that, you know, if we take a historical perspective, I don't think there's too much question that democracy is the most effective.
Has your opinion on democracy shifted since publishing your book, Is Democracy Failing, in 2018?
It's something that I've thought about a bit. And I mean, the main thing that's happened since I've so the book ends by sort of saying it might be, I think it sort of ends on a semi-hopeful or semi-pessimistic note, depending on how you look at these things, in that I sort of feel, you know, the notion that democracies have failed or is failing as a system, I think it's probably not, we're not quite there, but equally the threat that we're facing is a very serious one that could see democracy undermined. And since that book came out, obviously, one of the positives, given that the US has for many years been seen as a symbol of, like, democracy globally, one of the things that's happened is obviously Trump has been voted out of office and Biden has been elected as the US president, which sort of in some ways suggests something positive in that, you know, it's clear Trump was a populist leader that was undermining democratic processes. Equally, I think the underlying things that enabled him to do so are still there and are growing. You know, we see it with, you know, that I don't think I would have seen that January 6th event taking place. Like, I think, you know, just in terms of what that meant. And then, you know, efforts to at voter suppression. So increasingly we're seeing efforts to really at least serious conversations that seem to be occurring around different parts of the US and to undermine electoral processes. So I think there is a very real threat. The biggest thing that's happened since that book came out was obviously the pandemic, which has had a huge impact on all societies around the world. And I think the issue there, we've spoken about it a bit, but I guess what we haven't spoken about is what it means long term for the, you know, economically as well. And so I think there are like serious challenges ahead. So I don't think my views have changed too much, but I don't think so. But I certainly wouldn't. I think there could be a tendency to look at like what's happened in the US and be like, oh, maybe all of those, you know, concerns about democracy were overblown. I certainly wouldn't see it that way. I think the threat is still very much real. And I think democratic systems are under significant pressure. And I think if we look at Europe in the last few years, actually, particularly in sort of Central and Eastern Europe, things have gotten worse democratically. So it hasn't changed too much, but I still think it's a very sort of challenging time for democracy.
Looking ahead to the future, what do you think are going to be the key problems for democracy in the next 10 years?
So I think this issue of sort of polarization, which is sort of linked to this whole notion of like the culture wars and this sort of real divide between and this is quite a broad term and it means slightly different things in different contexts, but that sort of broad divide between liberals and conservatives or liberal politics, I think it seems to be growing. And I think the real worry is, as someone who I should say quite openly would identify on the more liberal side of that, I think the problems are from both sides. Certainly I think the sort of authoritarian trend in right-wing politics is a huge issue. But I think in terms of the actual polarization issue rather than the democracy issue, I think, you know, we see it on both sides where we simply do not hold those on our side to the same standards that we hold those from other sides. And I think that's a huge issue. And I think it's like the politicization of all life, you know, where, you know, if a corporation or if a company or a shop says something or it's seen as, you know, a more, you know, we shop here because this is a more. And I think in the US, that is a real thing of, you know, where you get your coffee from or where you. And again, I should say that as an outsider, and so it's probably overblown from it, from the way we see it here. But there's certainly, you know, the fact that those conversations are even happening, I think, is a really, really worrying state of things in terms of that polarization. So I think, you know, how we move past that, I think, is a really big challenge, because I think democracy will fundamentally be weak while there is that level of polarization in society. Well, you know, you've got that level of animosity towards those within your society or that have different political views. I think that's going to be a really tough one to move past. I think then the issue of economic inequality seems to be getting much worse. We're seeing, you know, and the pandemic has really heightened, you know, the sort of concentration of wealth amongst a very small elite versus, you know, lots of people globally who have really suffered economically due to the pandemic. And I think, again, it's sort of fueling it. It's both problematic in its own sense, but in terms of the types of democratic politics it's fueling, it gives huge influence to very few people, and it leaves a lot of people very dissatisfied with society in general. And often it's democratic politics that feels the brunt of that dissatisfaction. I think then things like, I mean, the climate crisis, I don't think we can even really begin to know quite how that's going to affect political life going forward, you know, the extent to which. And it will differ because, you know, the impacts will be felt very differently in different parts of the world. But I think there's going to be a huge issue of how, you know, how do we mobilize society to really be able to respond to the climate crisis? And what does that mean for democratic government? I think it's going to be a huge question. And I can't say I really have any sense of what that might be. But I think those are some of the challenges that we'll be facing for sure. And I also think just linked to all of that is that there, you know, with the rise of a, like, countries like China, you know, there is an appealing non-democratic model for many countries to follow. And yeah, I think that's a real challenge, that actually the fact that you do have powerful authoritarian states who are often seeking to undermine democratic politics, I think it's a huge problem going forward. And how do we respond to that? You know, it's again, so yeah, I would say those are some of the main challenges I think democracy faces going in the next 10 years.
And a final question, as we are the Oxford Society for International Development, and a lot of your research is around international development. So how do ideas about democracy and the threats it's facing link to international development?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think there's been a few things. I think with the threat to democracy, I actually think what we saw in established democracies, let's say like the US, like the UK, like other European countries, is actually mirrored processes that occur in many lower and middle income countries. So I think it's, as someone that has been involved in development for a while, I think there's at times you observe a slight self-righteousness around those that come from, you know, countries that are democratic towards those that come from countries that are, you know, poorer and often have, you know, more authoritarian politics. And actually, I think it helps us understand how these things happen. I think there's certainly been, you know, a case of like reflecting on how these processes occur. And, you know, it's a really complex mix of things that enables democracy to either flourish or not. And so I think it's sort of shed far greater light on those things and the role of, you know, economic aspects in actually enabling democracy to survive, I think, has been really important. I think in terms of health crises and challenges and, you know, the types of restrictions needed, I think, again, there's been a lot of, I think at times we've not necessarily appreciated the challenges that some lower income countries have really had to face in responding to these challenges and, you know, what that means for democratic societies to be able to survive and flourish. And I think, again, that's another big one. So if anything, I think the whole thing has meant there's far less of a, I think it's done too, both for democracy and for sort of development. There's been a real emphasis by a number of people that I completely agree with to move away from this notion of international development towards focusing on global development and understanding how, you know, in a more globalized world, how development processes are shaped and shape all of us and how we're influenced by them. And I think that's certainly the case. But I also think when we think about democracy, there's something similar going on. I think there's a sort of convergence of the ways in which we should think about the challenges to democracy. Actually, whereas before there was a real sort of, you know, that certain things would never happen in established democracies that happen, I think that sort of has been shown to be a bit of a myth. And actually, we can learn quite a lot from the politics of lower income countries to see how, you know, there are cases where democracy has flourished and even where there has been real economic challenges. And I think there's a lot to be learned from how that has happened and what we can take from that and use going forward. So I think if anything, it's sort of just lessen this whole divide between, you know, established democracies that are developed versus, you know, less developed countries that are more authoritarian. I think it's just reduced that sort of dichotomy in how we think about those things. So I certainly think that's been part of it.